This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballerman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballerman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 002. On this show today, I'm delighted to welcome Warren Bond, who's the co-founder of Matchy.biz, a business I wish had existed 15 years ago. We might touch on why I wish it had existed later in the show, but for now I'll note that the London FinTech Podcast is about bridging the worlds of financial services and fintech, and that Matchy.biz provides what I believe is an innovative way to bridge these worlds. Matchy, launched in November of 2013, is something of a cross between an innovation marketplace and a dating service. If these guys do what it says on the tin and grow what they have, then they are that rarest of things, a real game changer. So let's get on with the show. Hi, Warren, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So the structure of these interviews is thirdfold. In the second part, we'll come on to Matchy.biz. And then the third part of the show, maybe you can tell me what you think fintech is and where it's going and what the scene is down in South Africa. But first, I'd like to share with our audience something about who you are, where you're at, and any lessons you've learned along the way. From what I see on LinkedIn, you're a very busy guy. As well as being the co-founder of Matchy, you're the co-founder of Luminous, an innovative banking consultancy company, and then something which seems very interesting called Sport for All, which is described as South Africa's first social franchise. Not that I know what a social franchise is, with thousands of members around the country. So firstly, what we'd like to learn is how you make 25 hours in a day to do all this stuff.
Thanks, Mike. Well, I guess like most people, if you find your passion, you work hard at things that you enjoy, and I've been fortunate enough to be in that position. With Luminous, we've started a innovation fintech startup about 10 years ago, and have been fortunate enough to deliver via some of the banks a number of world first innovations in fintech, as well as a few regional firsts, and from that have learnt a lot about the space. And I'm sure we'll chat about it, but that leads us naturally into why we started Matchy and what we believe we can help innovators and banks achieve through that.
Sure. I mean, one thing I like about you guys is that you're doing the classic entrepreneurial thing, which is solving a personal pain. If you've gone through life and you found you keep spraining your ankle and you've got a way to stop spraining your ankle, then you know that that's something that's going to catch on with other people, as opposed to the opposite approach where someone sits in their garden shed, has a good idea, but it wasn't a pain for them. So just taking the Luminous one first, and also I'd like to just ask about the Sport for All. But on the Luminous one, we all know more than we did 10 years ago. What do you now know that you didn't 10 years ago that you would tell your younger self if you could go back?
That's a great question. I think there were some advantages in us not knowing enough. We decided to change an industry. At the time, we looked at banking and we looked at accounting. And one of our founders was doing financial statements and recapturing bank statements. And he said, this is crazy. Why doesn't a bank do my accounting for me? And that's really where things started. So we went and built a QuickBooks or Sage that we put inside online banking, went to the bank and said, you know, can we put this in? And I'll never forget, we got a phone call in the first week of the year to say the bank had decided to take our solution. And we were obviously thrilled and ecstatic. And it took another 15 months before they started implementing the solution. So I think one of the things we really learned is that with banks, you have long sales cycles. And often those sales cycles are just part of the challenge. It's also about implementation cycles. So banks tend to have very long development roadmaps that are planned out for a few years ahead. So whatever solution you're going to sell into a bank, you need to be able to do in a way where you can get that solution in quickly and easily for that bank and be prepared to fund yourselves while you wait for their cycles.
Yes, I mean, I mentioned earlier the fact that I wish you guys had existed 15 years ago. We may touch on that a little bit more in a minute. But I certainly remember in terms of personal pain, the first couple of big deals I did, by big I mean the better part of £500,000, which is enough for one person to struggle by on for a year. I got an agreement. They said, yeah, we want it, let's go. So I go home and crack the champagne. And then it's about 3 to 6 months before I've actually got it all signed on paper, which is a hugely frustrating and stressful process because, in particular, the business model I had at the time was what you could call elephant hunting.
Yes.
You know, you shoot an elephant, you can live for quite a while. you don't shoot an elephant, you're going to go quite hungry. So it is very difficult. There's a big asymmetry there for the seller and the buyer. At the same time, of course, the buyers, who kept me sort of chatting for a long time, they were being paid for all these meetings they were going to with me to keep me chatting. And I wasn't, and I was very, very acutely aware of that.
Absolutely. And I think, Mark, it also depends a lot on which market you're selling into. So if you take a market like the UK, there's only a limited number of banks. Australia, South Africa, pretty similar positions. India's got quite a few more. Versus somewhere like the US that's got thousands and thousands of banks. So if you're going to be selling to banks in the UK, you largely are elephant hunting.
Yes.
And that's the reality of the market.
Yes, yes. And I think that's another story for another day. I want to interview somebody at some point about the changes in financial services in the last 30 years. I mean, as we were just talking about before, a lot of these younger fintech companies, and what they understand by financial services is how it has been over the last 5 years, but it's changed an awful lot. And when I left Big Co in 1998, there were quite a lot of banks around, so I had good contacts in merchant banks, and I remember drawing up a list, and I think there were 12 or 13 or 14, and I was gradually nibbling away. I was selling to them one by one, but sadly for me, the list was disappearing faster than I was getting through it. So we are now in a situation where there's this vast oligopoly. Before we just get more into the banking bit, so what is the Sport for All, and what is one of these sort of social enterprises? It sounds very good, but I haven't a clue what it is.
Well, Sport for All is something we founded about 16 years ago. And what it does is it creates sports academies in the township areas in South Africa. So we've got 18 different sites currently. And why it's a social franchise is we learned a long time ago that it's quite easy to get funding for a project and run it as a funded project. But typically what happens is after 2 or 3 or 4 years, a chairman changes or the funder or something like that, and they head off and do another project. And then you have to look at a community and say, we've got to close down this project and we can no longer have the kids coached, etc. So after we had that kind of pain in the early days, we decided to put in place a self-sustainable business model, and franchising was the best way to do that. So now these franchises have somebody from the community who owns them, they have coaches from the community who get paid to coach, and they operate as self-sustainable businesses that feed into that community. And then fortunately in Sport for All, they have a lot of social benefits, keeping kids off the street, etc. But also they're just a great place for kids to go in the afternoon and play sport.
No, that sounds fantastic. I mean, does it actually filter up some good sportsmen, and will South Africa get better at football by the next World Cup and all that kind of thing? Or is that sort of a bit too grand?
It's not too grand. I mean, we've had quite a few people come through that have gone on to have trials and be picked for some of the local football teams, etc. The model at Sport for All is not just one sport. It's a multi-sport model. So you can, for example, play cricket on a Tuesday and play football on a Thursday. So a lot of kids do play multiple sports, but we've had a number of kids who've achieved success as they've grown older. But at the same time, that's a nice byproduct. The main reason we're doing for it is to get the kids off the street and enjoy playing sport.
Yeah, it's fantastic, actually. And quite often I wish I could clone myself. And I think if I could clone myself, then perhaps one of my clones might talk to you about bringing the franchise model over here, because certainly there's a big problem with lack of fitness and obesity in the UK. And one reason for that is that a succession of governments in their infinite wisdom have sold off all the sports fields and all that for money in the UK. So you've now got kids who are unfit, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And going back to sort of ancient times, sport was a very big thing in the UK, which we kind of exported around the world. And it wasn't just for sort of frivolity, and it certainly wasn't for money in those days, but it's because if kids get involved in sport, especially team sports at an early age, they learn a whole bunch of lessons that you would never learn in a school or in a university.
Absolutely. I mean, the life lessons are just enormous out of it. Funny enough, we have had the British Trade and Industry visit Sport for All once or twice, and let's see what the future holds. But it would be great to bring it over to the UK.
Yes, well, that's probably quite a good note to move on to Matchy.biz in terms of long sales cycles that we're talking about. And we'll come back onto it. I mean, before we get into Matchy, one of my pet frustrations is silly names for internet companies, and I've come across a lot of them. I'm not saying that Matchy is a silly name, but as somebody whose surname is Balliman, and so for many decades over the phone, I've been spelling it out. No, that's B-A-L, no L. I now called my current project LondonFintechPodcast.com, so very prosaic. But do you spend half your life explaining how to spell Matchy.biz over the phone?
Funny enough, no, actually.
Oh, I see. I just spelled it with two E's, actually. Like the Chinese, matchy.biz.
Right.
But anyway, for people who are listening, it'll be in the show notes, but it's M-A-T-C-H-Y machi.biz. Anyway, from the frivolity of how we spell Machi. So as I said earlier, it's a kind of cross between a dating service and an innovation marketplace, which again sounds incredibly grand, but what does that really mean in practice?
Well, perhaps to talk a bit about the journey of how we created it, I think we'll explain nicely what it means in practice. Myself and a bunch of the team come from really the innovator side, who've done a number of innovations ourselves and been involved with getting them into banks, selling them, implementing them, etc. And as we did that, we started to work with some people who came out of some of the most innovative banks in the world, who were on the other side of the fence, where they had to go out and look for innovations, travel to shows, see what was working in other parts of the world, etc. And we chatted about it and we just thought, well, why can't we create a portal, a website, a marketplace, a venue where innovators can list their innovations and banks can come in from the other side and look at these innovations and create a way where these people can talk to each other.
So it's a kind of almost like a clearinghouse. You've got a bunch of buyers and a bunch of sellers and you guys sit in the middle.
Yeah.
And you try and wire it up. And I know from looking at the website that both for the buyers and for the sellers, there are a variety of membership levels. And I think for anybody listening today, I definitely recommend that if you're trying to sell into banks, that you really go and check out these guys, not least of which, because as I recall, you get free membership for whatever it is, 1, 2, or 3 months or 6 weeks or something like that. There's a free trial membership where you can go in there, and from the innovators, from the sellers, your first price level is amazingly low in terms of you don't have to pay anything to be part of it, but you charge a 5% commission. And certainly in the days when I had my own fintech startups before fintech startups kind of existed, I'd have torn your arm off at the idea of sort of just giving you 5% for introductions. I mean, as anybody knows with any experience in business, to get that kind of high-level introduction to somebody who's interested in buying is worth many times that. So on the surface, it's a fantastic thing for people who are selling.
So yeah, Mark, when we looked at all the pricing of that, I mean, we really benchmarked a lot on the crowdfunding type models, your Kickstarters, Indiegogo, et cetera, et cetera. And there was a range of, without exact numbers, somewhere between sort of 5 and 15%. And we just felt 5 was a nice, soft
yeah, well, please
level
don't,
for an innovator.
Please don't put your price up, because then I don't want to take up the blame for you guys then suddenly charging 25%. But I think the important thing there about what you say about matching it, haha, to other types of industry is that with Interweb, you can provide the massive scale.
Yes.
That you can't face-to-face. So again, in the late 90s, when I was going around knocking on the doors of banks in London, selling strategic risk software, business management software for chief executives and CFOs, it was human face-to-face contact. Mm. So if you're going to introduce me to your Rolodex, it'd take you a long time to accumulate it. It would take a long time to transact. Whereas, of course, if you go online, then as long as it's set up, and maybe we can talk about more of the detail of that, then the marginal cost to you of matching up people is relatively low.
Absolutely. And I think the other key thing is that from the bank perspective, the guys who are members are the right, well, hopefully the right people in the bank. They're the innovation teams, the product teams, etc. So you get an answer pretty quickly as to whether they're interested or not. So that's not a highly intensive thing for us to be trying to find the right people within that organization.
Yes. Well, that's right, but just stopping on that one, because that interests me for a couple of reasons. I think, again, going back to my own experience in the past, and one of the things that people really miss out when they're talking about how fintech's going to disrupt the world or blow away banking, is that, and this may not be so obvious to people who aren't near banks, but where the whole banking journey has gone over the last 30 years has been from niche, speciated functions such as building societies who had a very simple business model, or stockbrokers or merchant banks, into vast financial conglomerates of hundreds of thousands of people. One of the problems with a challenge like that is, let's say I've got something and I want to find out whether Citigroup's going to buy it. Well, Citigroup's a vast organization all over the world. You know, I could spend the rest of my life trying to find the individual person on my own just by going around shaking hands. So from your perspective, we've spoken a little bit about how the sellers can interact with your service. From your perspective, how does it work for the buyers? How does it work for the banks? I mean, you've mentioned these innovation teams, and I've heard of one or two of them, but how does that kind of work?
Well, I think the market's coming to this place now where most of the banks are forming innovation teams or people with innovation responsibility within product or strategy teams. And so typically how it works is most of the guys we've met at shows, or they've contacted us because they've heard of us from colleagues at other banks, etc. And those are the guys who are out there looking for the innovations. So, I mean, for example, what you're talking about, these banks having so many staff members, one of the big Russian banks who's a member has something around about 280,000 staff members, which is just a huge amount. But we deal with, I think it's four of their guys who are their innovation team. And we know from, you know, just in the last few months, they're already engaging with a handful of innovators and are getting quite close to getting to proof of concepts, pilots, etc. with some of those. So generally, those kind of guys have the capability to implement pilots, etc. pretty quickly. To get a full rollout, obviously takes a bit more time with development roadmaps, etc. But we're comfortable that those are the right guys who can get to the right business units within their huge banks to get something going.
Yes, you raise a very interesting point, and this is a point for sort of people who are on the banking side of the fence who are listening, which is that in this massive wave of innovation we've got at the moment, a bank, especially at the senior level, can do quite a lot to make itself more amenable to innovation. It's very hard if you're the chief executive or chairman of an organization of hundreds of thousands of people to change the culture overnight and to get them all innovating. However, what you're saying is that based on your experience, merely setting up a unit of people who are presumably quite well plugged in around the place can massively facilitate innovation going into the bank compared to just passing down a memo or email or whatever they do these days saying, oh, please innovate.
Absolutely. I mean, look, and different banks have different approaches. I mean, you would have seen in the press been quite a number of announcements by banks with setting up big venture capital type funds for fintechs. We've got a member who's got a team of 16 people in the innovation team, two of which they've sent to live in California as a outpost to go and listen for innovations from Silicon Valley. You know, there's different approaches to it.
That's very interesting. I mean, the other thing you said a bit earlier I wanted to return to was that in terms of your incarnation in Luminous and your work on sort of innovation and banks there and your kind of perception of banks being innovative, maybe it's my jaundiced self, but certainly in terms of people in London, they don't normally use the word bank and innovation in the same sentence or without a not in between. So there's kind of different cultural thing going on in different marketplaces. So maybe just sort of touch on sort of South Africa specifically and then return to the sort of the rest of the world innovation.
Okay. Look, I mean, South Africa wasn't as hit by the crisis back in 2008 as the UK was, but it was still affected. Having said that, what we've seen is a lot of banks view that the only real way they can survive in the long term is to innovate. You know, there's a lot of fear amongst banks by the likes of what's coming from Apple, Google, Facebook, etc. And the feeling is if you don't innovate, you're going to be in real trouble in the next, you know, period of time. So we feel there's a natural burning platform for banks to innovate and to do something about innovation. I think in South Africa, there's been a situation where First National Bank was chosen as the most innovative bank in the world in 2012. From the Luminous side, we've been fortunate enough to do a lot of work with First National Bank and to be involved in some of their products. But I think that for a region has also created a catalyst to a lot of innovation in that market. So you're seeing the competitors now starting to do a lot of work around innovation. And that becomes a competitive issue beyond a survivability issue.
Yes, it's interesting because it comes to the point that although we increasingly talk about globalization, there are still cultural differences in business around the world. So obviously in the US and in the UK and parts of Europe, the banks kind of fell over and all of us taxpayers were forced to put our hands in the pocket and bail them out, which leads to a certain sort of situation and certain dynamic. But we often forget up here in the Northern Hemisphere that there's plenty of parts of the world where they didn't fall over.
Yes.
And they carried on like real businesses rather than bureaucratic corporations leaning on the sort of the government support. Moving on to the innovation, in terms of your database, how does that kind of work? I mean, one of the thoughts that I had was that one of the biggest innovations you can get is to invent a category that doesn't exist before. So do you have kind of a large miscellaneous bucket? You know, like you've got one bit sort of, oh, this makes accounting easier. Oh, this keeps track of your legal documents better. And then this is kind of something you haven't thought about before.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting if you analyze banking innovation, and I think this is a key message for a lot of innovators. So if you take, for example, one of the big banks we work with, they estimate about 75% of their innovations are, if you take the typical iceberg, below the waterline. Nobody actually sees them. 75% of their innovations, 75% of their return. They're all about innovating to improve existing processes, etc. And then 25% is the sexy stuff that the public sees and that has marketing behind it and billboards and those kind of things. And one of the messages for an innovator is, well, don't just think about the stuff that's going to be very sexy and on a billboard and out there. If you can come up with something which is going to, let's take a account opening process, for example. If you can do something that's going to reduce that from 9 steps down to 3 steps, the bank's going to be extremely excited about working with you. Typically, that might be KYC related. How does one get the documents through in a KYC process, which without involving branch visits or visits from relationship managers to the individual, et cetera, et cetera. So I think, you know, it's human nature to go for the really sexy stuff, but I think often there's a lot of stuff which is about improving the mundane,
which
is pretty innovative.
I entirely agree. I mean, you're preaching to the converted here because the mainstream media has been picking up on a lot of, in London, what's going on in fintech at the moment, and particularly, for example, last week, Lending Circle raised $65 million. And people can kind of understand peer-to-peer lending, and they can understand that $65 million is a lot of money. But there's plenty of fintechs that I've spoken to who are doing something where you would need a certain amount of financial sophistication to understand it in the first place. So that's never going to hit the mainstream media, but it's very vitally important. I think just wrapping up this point on the innovation, which is an interesting theme, I mean, a couple of things spring to mind, and it's very interesting to hear the marketplaces where people are thinking in this way. The first is that in the drugs business, the legal drugs business, well, it probably applies in the illegal ones too, but in the legal drugs business, for some time, drugs companies have had a problem around innovation. But lots of small companies have grown up near universities and taken some development and created stuff. And so then you're getting more of an ecosystem whereby you've got the large conduit who buys the innovation from outside, and that's a kind of a precedent. Which also makes me think of the article in the Harvard Business Review in, the, I think, 1990s called Unbundling the Corporation, which said in the future you're going to go to product-based companies or distribution-based companies or platform-based companies. Now, I'm not entirely sure that's happened, and I went to an innovation day on insurance last week, and actually what you've seen in insurance, rather like banking, is kind of the opposite. Actually, everything kind of sticks together. But if you slightly tweak that round and say that in these vast organizations it's quite hard to have a creative innovation culture, then they somehow need to have an arranged marriage, which I think is where you guys come in, with a bunch of innovators who are sort of sitting there wearing jeans and a t-shirt and don't really care about the corporate rules. And I think the other thing on this innovation, and again, just having met a lot of people recently in the fintech world, you can't get over enough the necessity for simplicity and clarity. And again, one thing I liked about your website, and I really recommend that people go and check it out, is there are two short videos, one for the buyer, one for the seller, embedded on the website. It's something like 1.5 and 2 minutes. And such a clear explanation in a way that I've never really seen before to banks about why they need to innovate and what needs to happen. And I think these things, when they're done well, and yours is a good example, say, are fantastic. All too often you see them and it's a bit confusing and it looks a bit too cartoony and all that kind of thing. So I think you guys are very good at that. To round up this section on Matchy, in 5 years' time you have, as I said up front, been the game changer, and the whole innovation inside banks is seen radically different, and people are drawing these analogies with drug companies, and you're the main intermediary. What are the kind of things that you guys yourselves will have had to do to make that happen? What do you see as the key sort of success factors? If I was your fairy godmother now and could wave a magic wand.
Yes. Look, I think there's probably two very different things in that. If you take things like the ATM, credit cards, online banking, mobile banking, I think all of those things over a period of the last few decades have been real game changers. And there's probably only a handful of those massive game changers in banking. So I think ideally we'd like to be in a situation where we've helped to proliferate a game changer through the industry. And that would be fantastic. And that would certainly meet a lot of our interest and passion and why we're doing this thing. I think at the second level, though, is we'd like to have been involved in proliferating a hell of a lot of incremental innovations.
Yeah.
So if, for example, if you look at Matchy, the sweet spot for Matchy is an innovation that's been deployed or tested or piloted somewhere in one bank in one geography. And typically what we see is that's because an innovator knows somebody in a bank, or, you know, we all know that it's who you know. So somehow you get that one sale, gives you a proof point, gives you metrics, etc. And then we as Matchy get involved in helping to proliferate that into other geographies, into other banks. So, for example, we've got a crowd at the moment we're doing some work with. They're based in Chicago. And we've put their innovation onto Matchy in the last 6 weeks or so. And they're suddenly in talks with banks in Australia, South Africa, India, multiple geographies. What we want to see.
Well, it's fantastic. I mean, and every time I sort of think about your story, the sort of the Mike Ballyman 15 years ago burst into tears that you didn't exist then. So I'm completely bought into it. So, okay, let's move on to the final thing, which is that you've been in fintech for a while in one way or another. We've touched on South Africa and how the scene is slightly different down there. And in particular, the thing that's going to stick in my mind is that there's a part of the world where people think of banks as innovative, which is certainly a game changer in my own head. But for fintech as a whole, sort of globally, it's a hot, sexy sector. There's eight-figure sums of money that are going into it right now. You know, where do you think the whole scene's going to go over the next 5 years?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. I think everybody's trying to grapple with this one. I think there's a lot of fear in the banking community being driven by what might come from the likes of Apple, Google, Facebook, etc., without it really having been seen to date. What that does mean, though, is that I think most banks are gearing themselves up to be able to deploy products, new solutions, innovations more quickly than they used to. So typically, things that are being built with APIs that can be easily connected, etc., are getting a lot more attention than innovations that involve deep changes into the bank, into its IT, into its infrastructure, etc. So I think typically the stuff that allows for quick integration and implementation is going to be what works and what wins. I still think there's a lot of space for the non-sexy innovations that are below the waterline. If you look at a bank's natural buying cycle, so let's ignore the sales cycle from the innovator's perspective, let's look at the bank side. It's a bit like the onion. They always got risk and compliance that they have to deal with.
Yeah.
So if you talk to a lot of the bank's IT guys, they'll tell you a major portion of their budget is spent on those items. So if you can create innovations that feed into that area, the likelihood of a bank taking them is actually quite good, and they have to spend money on those things. Then you get into more the core banking stuff, lending, etc. If you can create innovations that offer lending and helping the bank to run their business, that's going to be of interest to the bank. And then lastly is generally the sexiest stuff, which is the value add type stuff. And when the budgets get cut from banks and that's the stuff they take loss. So I suspect it's going to keep being about risk compliance, etc., then about core, and then lastly about the value adds.
Yeah, so I think I don't know, which is why I'm doing all these podcasts and interviewing interesting people such as yourself, so people can make up their own minds. But, you know, I suspect it's a little bit like telecoms. I mean, Skype has been around for a while, but telecoms companies haven't disappeared.
Yes.
And it's the same thing with banking. You know, there will be parts of it which will be taken away from it somewhat. But as long as banks hold all the money, yes, everything ultimately needs to plug back into a bank, unless we go down the digital currency route. Well, time's gone very fast, Warren. And as I say, I think that anybody who's a fintech who's currently selling into a bank really needs to check out what you guys are doing. And I hope it's very successful, because I think it will accelerate the process of innovation and of ultimately getting to a financial services sector that sort of serves the economy in a rather more stable and mature fashion than the problems we've had recently.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app, or sign up at londonfintechpodcast.com for email alerts for new episodes. Live long and prosper.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. To come away city, with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, with the faces so gray, with the pain of the everyday. the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight dance.